On this episode of Skeptico,
your ideas do not match up with the materialistic model of consciousness. Why do we have to dance around that?
Well, no, because some of my ideas could match up with the materialistic model of consciousness. And the reason the whole conversation that we're having right now has arisen because I was responding to what seemed like animosity on your part towards people who I hold in my heart as good people. Maybe their ideas are outdated or incorrect, and I think that probably that is the case, and I disagree with many of them. But they are good people who are trying to do the best thing in their work according to the data. And so,
but wait a minute, you're saying both things. You're saying that views are outdated according to the data, and then you're saying they're trying to do the best thing according to the data.
From their point of view.
Well, this is the process of science, then, is to remove us from our biases and to reveal, if we can, what point of view should dominate.
So I guess I'm wondering, do you hold the opinion that I don't make statements about this? Like, I publicly make statements about this all the time. But I'm trying to...
Why are you trying?
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode of Skeptico, it does, as you just heard, get a little bit testy, but I promise you it all comes out well in the end. And that, of course, is because we have an excellent guest, Dr. Julia Mossbridge, extremely well-qualified and extremely brilliant in the work that she's done. During this interview, we talk about a number of topics, including the title of this episode, Why Men Like to Be Right, and how that leads to psychic abilities. You don't want to miss that. Also her meta-analysis of presentiment work that pretty much, if it was a fair game, would put the nail in the coffin to the materialistic model of consciousness. But we know that isn't going to happen. And that's also what I talk about in what you heard in that opening clip, why we can't be more direct in declaring that the emperor has no clothes. Now, of course, if you're a professor at Northwestern University, there are probably a lot of different reasons why we don't want to say that the emperor has no clothes, but that is just my assumption. Maybe it is, just as Dr. Mossbridge is saying. Oh, but I'm tipping my hand way, way too soon. Let's get on with this interview with Dr. Julia Mossbridge. Today we welcome Julia Mossbridge to Skeptico. Julia, who is a visiting scholar at Northwestern University outside of Chicago, and also a staff scientist at the IONS Institute, which you've heard about many times on this show. She's a brilliant researcher on human consciousness and has some very interesting ideas about time perception and some other really cool stuff. So, Julia, once again, after we redid that introduction, welcome to Skeptico and thanks for joining me.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So we're going to bounce around a little bit because there's a couple of different topics I want to talk about. We're going to kind of have this interview and then I'm going to figure out how to slice it and dice it into a way that gives us the best chance of getting some of these ideas of yours out. So I hope it's not too disjointed and I hope people can follow along and listen to it. But then I'm really hoping that they can read it in a way that kind of makes sense too. So that's my goal.
Yep. Sounds good.
So let's start quickly with your background, if you will. Neuroscience and psychology, right?
Right.
So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So I in college and in graduate school, I studied neuroscience and computer science in college as well. And then in graduate school, mostly just neuroscience. I was in a PhD neuroscience program. And then that was at UC San Francisco. And then I left after I got my master's. It's called getting a terminal master's because you start to realize it's not the right place for you. This happens to some people. And I wasn't even sure I would be doing science anymore. I was very disillusioned. And I left and kind of did some growing up and then realized I did want to get my PhD, but I wanted to not work with animals. I wanted to work with humans as my subjects. And so I got a degree at Northwestern in psychoacoustics, which is the psychology of sound perception, and then did a postdoc in the psychology department to combine auditory with visual processing, as well as start to study other other aspects and psychology, and it all had to do in my mind with timing. I'm very interested in time, and since I was a kid, I've been wanting to understand the nature of time, and I don't know that I've made any progress at all.
Well, I think you've maybe made a lot of progress counter to the existing paradigm, which then can be interpreted as making no progress at all, right? Because it's hard to make progress when some of your conclusions completely upset and undermine the dominant theory about what time means in terms of how we perceive it, and in particular, what it means in terms of the neuroscience model of consciousness that you also seem to butt up against frequently.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I guess that's part of why I feel like maybe I haven't made much progress. But the other piece is I feel like I've opened a sort of a can of worms that was actually already open, but I sort of publicized the can of worms, and because of these results, and so now it's even harder to explain time. So if time were as simple as I initially thought it might be, I think I would have made progress. But I don't think that's the case. I think it's a pretty complex situation.
Well, is it time that's the problem or consciousness that's the problem? Because in listening to some of your presentations and reading some of your work, it seems like where we really have difficulty is when we try and match our perception of time with our perception of consciousness, which is really problematic in and of itself, given that we're still stuck in this idea that consciousness is a brain-based phenomena for the most part.
Right. And I'm not willing to say that consciousness is not produced by the brain any more than I'm not willing to say that consciousness is not produced by itself, that consciousness is not primary. I feel like I am agnostic about that, because right now there's no evidence that can fully support either direction. There's certainly, if I had to put my money on it, I would say, not that I have a lot of money to put on it, but if I had the money to put on it, I would say it's more likely in my book, based on the evidence, that consciousness is fundamental and that consciousness somehow produces matter, including the brain. But the mysterious question, I don't think it ends up being not as simple as one would hope. Because there is a very clear and intimate relationship between the brain and mind. As anyone knows who's had someone in their life who's had brain damage, right? There's a changing of the mind that occurs that's pretty clear. So you don't need sophisticated equipment to see that there's this relationship between the brain and mind. And the question always comes, whether you think the brain creates consciousness or consciousness creates the brain or some other story is going on, the question always comes, why should there be such a close relationship if one is not causing the other, or one is not, if there's not a reason for there to be a close relationship? You see what I mean?
I see what you mean, but I'm not sure on the causing one or the other. I mean, I think that, you know, the presentiment work that you did and Dean Radin did, who's at IONS, of course, completely violates the idea that consciousness is caused by the brain. But other phenomena violate it even more directly. So, you know, near-death experience, which we've really looked at a lot on this show, because it more directly kind of gets at the issue of, here is a severely compromised brain that is still generating this conscious experience, however we want to measure that. So to me, the idea that this strict model of consciousness being an epiphenomena of the brain, or even an emergent property of the brain, which is such a half-assed kind of nowhere middle ground that people try and get, I think has been falsified. So whether it's, you know, some kind of consciousness is fundamental, or, you know, whatever we want to come up with is fine. But I just think that the current model, the neuroscience model, I just don't know how we can kind of prop that up. But you seem to not be willing to completely overturn that, huh?
I guess partly because, I mean, yeah, I guess I'm not willing to completely overturn anything, because there's so many questions that come up. I mean, I'm definitely willing to say that the near-death experience, I mean, I've just been working on this book that we have a whole chapter about the potential survival of consciousness and stuff. So I've been doing a lot of research into the near-death experience stuff that I hadn't previously read, and it's very convincing. And it definitely suggests that there's something that can be disembodied about consciousness at certain times. But it's possible that there's this equation where at certain times consciousness is dependent on the brain and at other times consciousness is not dependent on the brain. Like that's a solution that seems to me to be plausible.
Well, hold on. Before we say right, how would that really make any sense? Again, trying to fit it back into what your colleagues there at Northwestern believe in terms of the neuroscience model and Christoph Koch at the Allen Institute of Science, who has the purse strings of Obama's $3 billion brain initiative. How does that really sync up with what those guys are saying? I don't think it does at all, but convince me.
No, I mean, I don't know if I can convince you. What I don't like is the following. I don't like the idea that I think I run across in post-materialist consciousness community that says, well, they're all wrong. And then this whole idea that consciousness is primary, or whatever you want to call it, is all right. Because there's problems with that model as well. And it doesn't take into, it sort of sees neuroscientists, and I guess part of it is defending my original field, right? It sort of sees neuroscientists as this sort of block of people who all believe in the same thing. And I've done that. I'm guilty of that sometimes in my talk. I'll say, well, you know, mainstream neuroscientists think this. But I mean, you name Christoph Koch. He's a panpsychic, panpsychist, right? He believes that matter is conscious, that it's a fundamental property, that consciousness is a fundamental property of matter.
Well, but I don't know how much he really believes that. You know, I tried to pin him down. I interviewed him a couple years ago, episode 160 of this show, and I really tried to pin him down because he kind of has this very, he's a wonderful talker and a wonderful writer, and, you know, he kind of says a lot of things that can be interpreted a lot of different ways. And I asked him directly about the neuroscience model of consciousness. And he said, your brain, this is his quote, your brain and only your brain, not your liver, not other parts of your body, give rise to conscious experience. That doesn't leave any room for your research. It doesn't leave any room for near-death experience, which I talked to him about. So I think to kind of paint these people as, you know, I don't want to paint them with a brush the way that you said, but to paint them as some kind of open-minded kind of voyagers into all that might be, boy, I just don't see any evidence for it.
Well, right. I get it. And I'm trying to be open-minded here because there's so much that we don't know, right? There really could be a story. I mean, we're really babies when it comes to understanding consciousness. And what we have are little bits of data. We have a little bit of data from the near-death stuff, and we have a little bit of data from presentiment, which, by the way, I do think could be explained completely by brain activity, as long as you don't assume that we're conscious of future events, but that our non-conscious processes are actually getting information about future events, and that that's all done by the brain. And so if the brain is presenting to our conscious awareness the information it wants us to know, it could be that it doesn't want us to know about those future events that the rest of the brain is aware of. So I don't think that presentiment or precognition necessarily implies disembodied consciousness. But I do think the near-death experience stuff is way, way closer to me supporting that. But I also just think we have to take proper humility here and say, it could be way more complicated than we think. It could be that when you are living your life and you're not on the and not dying, there is a real situation where the brain is actually creating consciousness while you're awake. And then while you're asleep, it could be that, in fact, consciousness is creating your brain, right? And then that same kind of sleep state where consciousness is creating matter could happen after you die. I mean, in other words, there's so many complexities to this. So I kind of don't blame anyone for holding any opinion because we're all idiots, right? We're all trying to bumble forward with the data we have, and there are many explanations for each piece of data. Although, again, I think you have to do something with the near-death experience data. You have to take those into account. There's a lot of really solid evidence there that there's some way in which consciousness can exist without the brain being functional, right? So I'm on your side about that. But I also hate that there are sides because I think it's way too early for us to have sides.
It's at the same time way too early and way too late. One of your presentations, actually a couple of your presentations, you reference turn of the 20th century, early 1900s, famous psychologist William James and his understanding of consciousness as being beneath the trees, the roots that mingle together, and you explain how that fits nicely with what you've discovered. So we've had 100 years to kind of
Yeah, he called that cosmic consciousness, which is sort of like deep consciousness, which is different than what neuroscientists are talking about. They're talking about everyday waking consciousness, the experience of having an experience.
But they're talking, hold on, they're talking about that because they deny the existence of cosmic consciousness. So there's a difference between saying, well, geez, they're just focused over here in their little end of the sandbox. No, they are saying their sandbox is all there is. So again, you know, maybe we're at the infantile stages of this, but maybe there's a reason for it. And maybe the reason for it is that to perpetuate this materialistic model of consciousness kind of fits a lot of things that we like about science. And for that reason, there's no way that these guys are going to ever give it up. So I don't need to bash Christoph Koch, but...
Good. They're not all guys. So first of all, they're not all guys. A lot of neuroscientists are women. And second of all...
Really? What percentage? I don't see any of the main people that rise up above and are really kind of out there.
Sure, of course. Well, that's the problem in basically every academic field, except for some of the social sciences. So there's about 50% of neuroscientists, depending on the level. So at graduate school, there can be even greater number of women in neurosciences. And then, of course, because of the way the world works, they get plucked out over time. So anyway, that's just a note about sexism in science. But I get it. I get what you're saying, and I'm sympathetic to it. And I want to give people the benefit of the doubt and don't villainize them because they may eventually change their minds if you're even handed about the data. I mean, if you've ever had someone who has brain damage and who can't function because there's some part of their brain that has been damaged, it's hard to go around saying that, well, they should be fine because consciousness creates the brain, so the consciousness is not damaged, just the brain, because you experience that their consciousness is damaged. So that's a real thing that happens to people that also needs explaining, just like near-death experiences are real things that happen to people that need explaining.
Sure, but Julia, no one ever said that. I mean, even if we take the very simplistic and overused, but at the same time useful model, that the brain is somehow a transceiver. It's like your television, only it can receive and transmit at the same time. So, of course, if the television set is somehow malfunctioning, then the signal is going to be distorted when it comes in. And again, that's an oversimplistic model of consciousness, but it does fine to explain why if you have a bad bump on your head, you no longer experience that consciousness the same way. To get out of that kind of third grade explanation, and I'm sure you know this, but you know, Dr. David Nutt in the UK and his group, when they just published their psilocybin experiment and they gave these folks these great mushrooms and then they put them under the fMRI and they found that no, their brain wasn't firing more because of the mushrooms. It was firing less.
Well, it depends on what part of the brain you're looking at. They were looking at the default mode network, and the default mode network was less active in terms of, you know, the amount of oxygen it needed and the amount of metabolic activity that it was. You know, there was a reduction in metabolic activity in the default mode network, and they themselves suggest, well, this is maybe like the filter. Maybe this is like the filter theory of the brain, where there's part of the brain, right? But they're changing it. They're not saying that the authors themselves said. It's not that they're saying that the mind is being filtered by the brain. That would be too far from their worldview, right? It's that in their worldview, this part of the brain, the default mode network, is reducing its activity, and that allows the rest of the brain to sort of go haywire and have all these wacky experiences, right? So you're letting in information that you wouldn't otherwise let in.
But again, as you just alluded to, that's kind of a working backwards from the answer you want. I mean, surprising conclusion. The brain areas that we expected to show more excitation, more firing, more activity were suppressed. So, you know, let's find an explanation. My point is that there's bits and pieces of evidence that are kind of all over the place, including some of your work, that the simplest explanation for them is an overturning of the dominant paradigm. And I don't quite know why you're defending it so vigorously, but
I'm not really defending it that vigorously. I mean, most people in the mainstream would say I'm kind of nuts because of this stuff, right? And to take the near-death experience stuff seriously, most people in the mainstream would say that that's kind of nuts. I'm not defending it vigorously. I'm just defending a sense of humility around no one should be vigorous in defending any position around consciousness because we know so little. And at the same time, we need to be open-minded and skeptical and rigorous about what we're doing, right?
Wonderful in principle. But again, let's return to the pragmatic reality of your position at Northwestern University and your scholarly paper that received 60,000 views on Frontiers of Psychology, 60 times more than any paper I could find. And, you know, a few years ago, I talked to Jeffrey Schwartz at UCLA, one of the world most recognized experts on OCD, who said kind of the same thing. He said, hey, you know, I published this paper, groundbreaking, got all this praise. And I'm told by the head of my department, hey, buddy, you're lucky you have a job. And he says, you know what? I am lucky I have a job. And let's talk about Christoph Koch, like we talked about, who holds the purse strings to the $3 billion budget. They don't want to hear any of this stuff. So in the same way that you want to be open-minded and magnanimous and kind of share the thing, I just don't know that that really works. And in the same way that we're talking about William James said all this stuff 100 years ago, I think the band marches on. We just need to be truth-telling is all. And the truth-telling is that it's bullshit. I mean, it's bullshit. It just doesn't hold together what they're pitching.
Yeah, I guess I disagree with that. I think that what works is for each person to act according to the nature that they feel, right? And my feeling, so who I am is a person who wants to assume the best in other people and to assume that scientists will eventually change their minds when they see the data and to work towards that by producing good data. And that's where that paper came from. That I think part of why so many people saw that paper was because my colleagues who wrote it with me and myself, we tried very hard to be as rigorous as we could possibly be. And I think that's why no one has so far been able to find any major problems with that. Although I got into a bloodbath sort of fight with this guy, Sam Schwarzkopf, who thought he found some problems in it, but it was a really nice kind of bloodbath in that we had a nice collegial sort of set of papers exchanges about it. But, I guess this is the way I work. This is, and maybe I'm wrong, and maybe it's better just to say those people are bad and these people are good. I don't think that makes progress.
Matter of bad and good, though. It's just a matter of a little bit of truth-telling. So I'm great. I'm down with what you're saying about truth-telling. But part of that truth-telling is putting out in as clear a way possible what the other person is representing is their truth, and then attacking that, if you will. That's what good science is about. It's saying that, you know what, this doesn't hold up for these reasons, or this data seems to contradict that data.
I don't think that's what good science is about. What good science is about, or at least what I have, the reason I'm in science is because I experience a mystical connection with the universe when I do science. And I feel like I am almost dancing with nature. And good science is about being open to whatever comes out of that dance and then reporting it. And if someone else has a different view, it's because they have done experiments that give them that different view or they believe a different bias. And I totally agree with you. There's a worldview bias among scientists that we have this idea that we're trained into for sure. And I was trained into it. The materialistic assumption is absolutely correct. And you have to bend your conclusions to match the materialistic assumption. And some people are still trapped in that. And I don't consider myself trapped in that because I'm very aware of it. I'm open to that it may be correct in some cases, but I'm also open. It's clear to me that it's not correct. It can't explain other situations. But I'm sympathetic to people who are trapped in it because there's so much social pressure when you're coming up as a scientist to fall into that. And you are made fun of. I remember being made fun of when I told my fellow neuroscientists at UCSF or neuroscience graduate students that I think I was at least a dualist in that I believed that there were such things in the world that are not physical, that are mental. Well, now that's like a standard position in neuroscience, that consciousness is mental, it's not physical. I mean, there are many neuroscientists who hold that sort of dualist view, but I was really mocked. And now I'm not even sure there are physical things, right? I'm not even sure the physical reality as we think of it exists. Which is very far from most neuroscientists' position, not all. But still, I'm sympathetic because I was there too. You know, I was, it is easy to get trapped in that and to assume that that this way lies craziness if you start to believe that consciousness is something unto itself that is not produced by the brain.
So say that last part again. What is craziness?
It's easy to believe because you're trained that going down the path of thinking that consciousness has something that maybe doesn't have to do with the brain or isn't produced by the brain, you're basically taught that way lies craziness. Like, you might be crazy if you think that, and anyone who thinks that is going insane, and that's a drug-induced idea. I mean, there's a lot of fear.
Right. So why can't we be more direct in just kind of exposing that as not a very worthwhile belief system, which you seem to be kind of saying both. You seem to be saying you don't ascribe to that, and you've seen your own path out of that, and yet you see other people who are there, and yet there's something wrong with saying that view, that worldview, that paradigm doesn't fit the data. Why is there something wrong with saying that doesn't fit the data?
I think you're making it up. I didn't say that. I'm writing a whole book with Iman Sparus about how that, in fact, doesn't fit the data. I mean, it's an entire book about that idea. So I really don't think I'm saying that, and it's going to be published by the American Psychological Association. So I don't think that there's anything wrong with that. I act in my life according to that. What I'm saying is it's...
But that's what I was saying.
You were saying that the way science is done is by attacking.
No, I'm not saying by attacking necessarily, but I mean, this is the scientific process of asking questions, sure, countering other people's assertions. I mean, it doesn't have to be bloody knuckles or anything, but I mean, it does. Your ideas do not match up with the materialistic model of consciousness. Why do we have to dance around that?
Well, no, because some of my ideas could match up with the materialistic model of consciousness. And the reason the whole conversation that we're having right now has arisen because I was responding to what seemed like animosity on your part towards people who I hold in my heart as good people. And maybe their ideas are outdated or incorrect, and I think that probably that is the case, and I disagree with many of them. But they are good people who are trying to do the best thing in their work according to the data. And so basically,
wait a minute, you're saying both things. You're saying that they're outdated. You're saying their views are outdated according to the data. And then you're saying they're trying to do the best thing according to the data.
From their point of view.
Well, this is the process of science then, is to remove us from our biases and to reveal, if we can, what point of view should dominate.
So I guess I'm wondering, do you hold the opinion that I don't make statements about this? Like, I publicly make statements about this all the time, but I'm trying to...
Why are you trying?
Because I hold these people in my heart as good people who are trying to do their best, and I don't want to knock them as people. They're not... They as people should not be maligned for them trying to do what they think is best, and eventually... The data of given time, they will. I believe that they will look at the data and say there's something there. I just believe that, and so maybe I'm wrong, but that's what my nature leads me to believe, and so I keep working towards more and more clearly stating, here are the data that don't work because there's a problem with the method, or there's a problem with the level of rigor, or there was a bias on the part of the experimenter. Here are the data that do work. This is what I believe. Done. And then they're, you know, they have their own set of data that they're looking at. Like Chris Koch is looking at networks in, you know, mouse brains and rat brains, right? And so he's got his own set of data, and his data are like, well, then I see this and I see that. So everyone's operating on the data that they see. And so I just won't have these conversations where those people are bad and these people are good. They're just not bad people.
Okay, they're not bad people. And Christopher Koch seems like a really nice guy, and he seems like to be a nice family guy, and he seems like he loves his kids and all the rest of that, right?
And he's an excellent researcher in his world, according to his worldview. He's an excellent researcher.
He's an excellent researcher. That's fine. I'm sure he is, and that's why he was promoted, and he got all this money at his fingertips and all the rest of this. But when you throw in according to his worldview, I mean, I don't know why we have to be so uber sensitive to just reporting things the way that we see them. I don't have anything personally. I love everyone, right? And because I think we're all connected. I don't think there is a you and me down at the lower level. I think we're connected at a much deeper level. But I do see the disadvantages of holding to a particular worldview, a particular paradigm. And as far as you expressing that, hell yes, I've heard you say that and talk eloquently, forcefully, and with some very compelling evidence about the counter position to that. So I understand to a certain extent what you're saying about why you don't want to malign people, but I don't think that's necessary. I think if we walk around and thinking that everyone is in science is going to be so thin-skinned that we can't challenge their assumptions, I just don't think we'll get anywhere. In particular with, you know, you talked about near-death experience, and gee, we have to look at it. I mean, there's a clear bias, which you again admit, against understanding, reporting, or synthesizing any of that data into the mainstream view. So if you want to say we should all sit around on our hands and wait another 20 or 50 years until science gets on board with an overwhelming body of data, I say, hell no, we don't have to sit our hands and wait.
Well, see, I don't want to say that, and I didn't say that. What I think is true is that that is the case. What I think is true is it doesn't advance things by attacking people. What advances things in science is by data, 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 data.
That's a matter of style, then.
It's a matter of style. So let's have a conversation about what we think would advance things. I mean, what I think would advance things in this field, in the post-materialist field, what would advance things is funding. So there is so little funding because of the bias, right? If you want to really push the needle on this, arguments do not persuade scientists. In fact, arguments tend to turn scientists in the opposite direction. Like, why are you arguing so vehemently? You must not have good data. This just must be an emotional thing for you, right? That is the way scientists generally approach people who argue.
Don't agree, but go ahead.
Well, and that's my experience with people who argue vehemently. It's like, well, just look at the data. They're convincing. We can just be calm about this.
No, my experience in getting really down and dirty on some specifically published papers and reviewing the data extensively with the scientists who are on both sides of it, no, they just don't really care about the data. They care about defending and promoting their worldview, like we all do. None of us like to change our beliefs. But please go talk about the funding, because I think this is the siren song that so many in any kind of alternative science get romanced into. No, I'll go along. I'll be good so that you give me the funding. It doesn't work. That's why parapsychology has been co-opted and now is basically run by people who it let them into the tent and have now said, oh, really, parapsychology is about anomalous psychology. It's why people believe weird things. So it's the field has kind of gone nowhere. So, but go ahead, let's chase the dollars. How are we going to do it?
Well, no, because now it feels like you're being sarcastic about it. I don't understand. I guess I'm trying to understand what you want from me as an interview subject. Do you want to know my opinion on this, or is this a political conversation? I just don't get it. I'm trying to get what you want from me, and I would love.
Well, it's kind of morphed into more of a dialogue, which is fine. But I mean, where you were going is a path that I've seen over and over again. So I'd love to hear, you know, where I thought you were going when you said that is, look, we all got to kind of be nice here so we can get the grant money.
No. God, no, I don't understand who you think I am. I don't understand. I just like being nice because it makes me feel good. When people are attacking or vehement, I'm always just like, why? That doesn't make you feel good. It doesn't make me feel good. So no, I just want to be nice and have a conversation.
Well, we can oppose each other and still feel good or be feel good. I don't get that, but go ahead.
Depends on who you are. Actually, just physiologically, women have a really hard time with conversations like this, just so you know. Men are fine with facts, tend to thrive on conversations like this. Women, it's horrible. It just feels like I'm being attacked all the time. And I hate it. So it's part of why women don't last in the sciences, because of this kind of stuff. And it's just a stylistic thing that really matters for half of the population, and doesn't seem to matter for the other half. So having said that,
Well, let me just explain a little bit. I mean, there is a pretty big divide. If someone wanted to go and look at your presentations, let's say in front of the folks at the Science and Non-Duality Conference, where you're pretty vocal about the silliness of the materialistic paradigm, you're pretty open that the contemplation crowd and the enlightenment crowd may have come to conclusions that seem to be more in line with the cutting edge science that you've seen and the cutting edge science and near-death experience than the neuroscience model. So there just seems to me to be quite a difference between not only the tone, but the content of those presentations and the other ones I've seen on the internet and what you're telling me in this interview. So I'm trying to bridge those two. And if I'm kind of in your face a little bit about it, well, yeah, maybe there is a style difference there. Believe me, I have the utmost respect for your work. And you as a person, I think is awesome. But one of the things, if I can go on and on, which I shouldn't really do here, but one of the things that really pisses me off about interviews is these fluff interviews that just talk about meaningless points that no one wants to hear about. I mean, if there is a difference here, if there is a difference of opinion, I like to hear people talk about it. It doesn't mean that I don't like you or respect you. It's just that I have a driving need to try and understand that difference between the Science and Non-Duality Conference and this conversation.
Yeah. So if you want me to tell you the difference, I can tell you the difference, but you got to listen to it because this is what my experience is of the difference. My experience is that anytime someone comes at me and seems like that when I say a perfectly reasonable statement, like we're kind of idiots and we don't know what consciousness is about and we don't understand models. And of course, the post-materialist worldview makes sense in some cases. And of course, the materialist worldview makes sense in other cases. And then starts attacking people who I hold as dear to me as scientists. I'm going to defend those people.
Who did I attack that you wanted?
So I'm going to defend those people and I'm going to defend the idea that we even know enough to be able to say for sure it's this way and those people are idiots. I know it makes...
But Julia, when did I say he's an idiot? I just gave you the quote that he gave me.
You're right. I had implied that. You're absolutely right.
What did I do other than to give you the quote that he gave me?
I would have to replay the tape, but my experience, yeah, so maybe I made it all up, but I don't think so. My experience was that you were saying, like, look, that you wanted to build some kind of dramatic difference. And I think this dichotomy, yes, I totally think that that worldview doesn't work in many cases, and it does work in some cases, and I'm sympathetic with people who hold it. And so anytime anyone's going to attack someone who holds any opinion about consciousness, I'm going to defend any person and their opinions about consciousness, because we know so little, that person could be right. There could be some weird explanation we haven't thought of. And so, yes, if I had to put my money on it, and I am putting my time and energy into it and my life's career into it, of course, I don't think the materialist worldview works at all for an explanation for consciousness. But when it comes to people, I'm going to defend any scientist's right to believe anything, because it is so weird. Consciousness is such a weird phenomenon, so not understood, that coming down hard on any point of view, you know, I'm going to come down hard on my point of view because that's my job, right? But coming down on anyone else as having the wrong point of view, no. So what I do is I put out there and I say, this is what I think is the reasonable point of view. This is my point of view. Here are the data. And then if someone else says, well, I think I have this point of view, I say, great. So how does that work with these data, right? But I just, so that's all I'm responding to. So the big difference between SAND, which is where I'm just talking to a group of people who are totally sympathetic with the post-materialist point of view and not coming down on anyone, and talking with you, is that it felt to me like someone I knew and cared for was being attacked. That's all.
In your presentation at the Science and Non-Duality Conference, you put up a picture of Chris Koch and you read his quote that he published in the Huffington Post on what is consciousness.
Yeah, that was my working definition of a neuroscientist's view of consciousness.
Right. And you also said that neuroscientists, but you also kind of painted him as maybe being more open-minded than we think. And to that, I told you in my interview with him, he was quite emphatic when I tried to push him in that direction and say, hey, maybe we should look at this near-death experience data and all the rest of that. He was quite emphatic in saying that, no, we don't need to look at it, that there's nothing there that we really need to worry about.
I think he's wrong. I think he's wrong about that. But when you originally...
And he said, your brain and only your brain, not your liver or other parts of your body, give rise to consciousness.
Right. I think he's wrong about that. But I think he's going off of data that he knows well. And he doesn't know the near-death experience data well. I just think he's going off the data that he knows well. And I back to the funding issue, I wasn't about to say we should all act good. I don't act well and not talk about this stuff so we can get funding. That's nuts, because you don't get funding by not doing anything. I don't have a tenure track position at Northwestern. And one of the reasons for that is that I've pursued this work. And I tried for years to get tenure track positions at very many academic institutions. One of the reasons I didn't is because of this work. I was explicitly told, take this off your resume. Your resume looks great without that stuff on it. And I said, no, this is what I'm interested in. This is the direction I'm going. Absolutely not. I mean, there's no way in which I bend on that. And there needs to be more funding for people who are already doing this work, not for people who don't know how to do this work and don't know the field, but for people who are already doing the work and know the field and know how to do it. And that funding is just incredibly minimal right now. And I think that's how the field has changed. So I wasn't saying we should all play nice. I get that. I think you've got a different opinion of who I am based on my wanting to defend Chris Koch, you know, whom I would still defend, not as necessarily holding the right model of consciousness, but as having the right to hold any model of consciousness that he wants based on the data that he's seen, simply because it's very complicated and he is not familiar with this other data. So he is easily going to dismiss it. So that's my position on that. So yeah, please don't assume that because I feel it's important for everyone to have their data and not be maligned for it, that I don't go out in the world and say what I think is true. I do that.
And malign them for it. I mean, I just don't know where you go with that. I mean, that just becomes a difference of style, and we've already kind of gone over it, and probably I've pissed you off to the level that we're not going to be able to recover and have a productive conversation about it. But I mean, you just said, Julia.
Jesus, Alex, can you stop for a second? I have not. I just want to talk with you. I feel like constantly there's this, like, you are one person and I'm in this other person, and there's this, why does there have to be this thing between us? I don't get it. Like, why do you think that you've pissed me off to the point where we can't have a conversation? We can. All we need to do is just talk, but not in an angry way.
Well, we only have 6 minutes left.
Well, I can tell my son to go in another room and we can still, I'm committed to making this work.
It's already working. I mean, it's all working. People love this kind of back and forth, right? They do, especially men who are the majority of people who listen to this kind of stuff, particularly the science stuff. I have a lot of women who listen to the show, like the show. But so let's have a conversation. What's the conversation that we should have?
Well, I think there may be people in the audience who don't actually even know what that paper. Do you think anyone in the audience wouldn't know what my paper was about and what my research is about? Because I kind of feel bad that we've been talking about all this stuff around it, but then haven't directly talked about it. Or do you think everyone will know about it?
No, they won't. I was just going to kind of get there I mean, we've kind of gotten there, but I think that part of the problem in talking about these papers is the framing of the conversation, which we were doing. And, you know, these conversations can go in a totally different way. So this conversation has gone in a totally different way than I had planned, right? So that's okay. That's cool. But as far as your paper, I mean, we just talked about the David Nutt paper, right? And we talked about it in 30 seconds and we really got to the meat of it. Well,
yeah.
So I think we could talk all about your paper and why boys like to be right, you know, which is really cool. But yeah. The point is, to me, the point of that paper, here's my problem. We're going to talk about that paper, but I have to start by telling you the point to me of that paper. And then you can tell me, since you're the author of it and the person who did the research, you can tell me what the point of it is. But the point of it is that, you know, it's the world isn't what we think it is. It isn't this neuroscience model of consciousness. You are not a biological robot in a meaningless universe. And that is the message that gets pounded into you everywhere you turn in terms of science My kids, my four kids who go to school, that's what they're taught. And sometimes it's a subtly packaged message, and sometimes it's a directly packaged message. Depends on what branch of science they're studying. But the message is, you don't exist. And as far as us connecting in a loving, compassionate way that really recognizes the higher consciousness in both of us, you know, we really have to do that on the sly, because science doesn't really give us any room to even acknowledge that. So that, to me, is where your paper fits. Now, to you, maybe it fits in time perception and all the rest of this stuff, but to me, that's kind of the sub-story. So that's my understanding of your paper. Now you tell me what your understanding of the paper is.
Well, no, I totally agree with you on this. The sub-story is time perception, and that our non-conscious processes know more about the future than our conscious awareness. And you're right. I totally agree with you that the message that we are just random, the universe is a stochastic process with no meaning, and humans apply meaning to it that doesn't exist outside of humans, is pounded in all the time, because that's thought to be what science is all about, right? And we're essentially in this culture, we deify science at this point. So that is our meaning. And so since science is our meaning and the scientific process is our meaning, then the scientific process that says everything is essentially meaningless becomes the meaning. So it's fascinating. Anyway, I totally agree with you there. That is not the underlying point, but in a way, the overarching point. So the paper that we're talking about is this meta-analysis that I did with Patrizio Trisoldi and Jessica Utz, showing that across 26 experiments from 1978 to 2010, that human physiology, most of which we are completely unaware of, seems to predict upcoming events that are important to the participant, so that are important to the person whose physiology is being measured. And the reason it would have this implication, and what I think is, Alex, I think this is the most profound implication of any of my work and any of the people who do this kind of work, is that the event has to be important to the participant. So getting information about the future seems like such a almost science fiction type thing to do. Like there should be, like when I think of, you know, Einstein's block universe, like, oh yeah, you're just looking at a different slice of the block universe and you're getting information about an event from the future. But no, it's not just that, because it's not just an event. It's an event that matters to you. And that your ability to get information about, because there are many, many, and there's an infinite number of events going on at any one time, but you're not just getting information about what the frog is doing, you know, on the side of the road. You're getting information about an event that matters to you that ends up making the universe personal. And so it ends up showing you that there is not just meaning that you're creating, you know, in your mind, but it shows that there's some kind of a mechanism in the universe that depends on meaning, depends on whether something's important to you in terms of your ability to access information about it. So I totally agree with you. That is the profound point of that paper. And actually, so far, no one else has come up to me and said that, I think, is the profound point of your paper. So thanks for saying that.
Julia, tell folks, listeners, about why boys like to be right.
Oh, I have no idea.
No. Your fantastic study that you did at Northwestern.
It's more like that study showed that boys like to be right, but I don't know why it is.
Yes, right. We don't know why. Right.
Maybe testosterone. Yeah, so that study was looking at the same kind of idea that your physiology can predict an upcoming event that's important to you. And so
let's simplify that for us a little bit, in case I want to bring that out and make that a clip. So your physiology.
Your physiology can predict.
And what is your physiology?
Yeah. So physiological systems, everything from your heartbeat to your changes in your skin conductance, to changes in respiration, to changes in blood volume, to brain changes, all of these have been shown to predict future events that should not normally be predictable.
Because they are, in the current model, unconscious processes. They're not something we are aware of, right?
Yeah, they are generally unconscious processes for most people. And some people, every once in a while, will have this presentiment experience that becomes conscious. So their physiology could change, and then they say, wait a minute, there's something going on. There's something that's about to happen, and then something will happen.
Right. So I feel a tightening in my chest, and I've associated that with something that's about to happen. And then at some point in my life, I learned to trust that, and I'm not even consciously aware of it, but that thing kind of happens. So that's kind of along the lines of what you were hoping to study in this experiment, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So I had Northwestern, Psych 110 students. So that's the first psych course they take, and they have to do some research as part of that. So be participants in research. And so I had them come in and hook them up to a skin conductance machine. So it's measuring the changes in the electrical conductance of their skin, which is related to arousal. So when you get more aroused, your skin conductance goes up, and it's like a lie detector test in a way. And I give them a computer program where they're looking at a computer monitor, and they had to choose between four images. And the question I asked them was, look, this is kind of a crazy question, but try to guess which image is going to be shown to you, which of these four images is going to be shown to you after you choose one of the images. So it's like, try to predict the future.
Now, to them, I would think anyone who sat down in front of that experiment, it's kind of nonsensical. It's like, what do you mean, choose which one wins? I mean, it doesn't make any sense. But then that's part of the game, right?
That's right. And I sort of laugh with them about it. Like, okay, I'm going to ask you to do the crazy thing, you know? and they like that. And so they say, okay. And I said, I'm hooking you up to this, skin conductance thing. We'll just, see how you respond. And they say, okay. So they can sit around as long as they want. And then when they decide, they click on one of the images, and then a random number generator chooses one of the four images to be shown to them, and then shows them that image that it shows, right? And people are not very good at this. As we all know, consciously predicting the future is hard, right? That's pretty much our experience. But their physiological processes, which tend to be not conscious for most people, do show an effect. And if you look at the very first trial, so you don't have to worry about the effect of previous trials, it looks like for men, it's very statistically significantly different between men and women. So when I'm talking about men, I'm really talking about 17 and 18-year-old college students. So I don't know if they're men or not, but they're young and they're male. And it looks like their skin conductance increases highly significantly when they're about to be right, when they're about to be correct, to say this is the image that actually shows up about 10 seconds beforehand. And versus when they're about to be wrong.
So again, the study hoped to find or sought to try and understand whether or not your physiology, in this case, the skin conductance, is somehow related to some future event. And then tying that back to what you said earlier, you said you had this hunch that you've confirmed in further research that our physiology is able to predict future events if they're meaningful to us, if they're important to us. So the kind of interesting twist here is maybe boys or these young men are more motivated to be right than the girls are. Is that kind of where it...
The difference in the physiology is apparent both before, 10 seconds before, and 10 seconds after they find out that they're right. So for the boys, there's a huge difference in the arousal when they're correct versus when they're incorrect. For the girls, there's no statistical difference afterwards. And beforehand, there is a slight statistical difference, but it's in the opposite direction. So they're actually less aroused when they're about to be right. So this goes along with Daniel Kahneman talks about this in Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow in his book, that women have a hard time with winning in our culture. So yeah, so in Thinking Fast and Thinking Slow, Daniel Kahneman talks about how women have a hard time with winning or succeeding. And I think it's because, and this is complete, I'm not a social scientist, so this is just me talking about my own experience as a woman. But I do have experience as a woman, and I think that that connection for women is really very important. And when you win, there's a false belief, I think, among many women that if you win, someone else loses. And
is that why my daughter always gives me a hug after she beats me in soccer?
Yeah, because you've lost. And she, and the connection is more important than the victory.
But she still beats me every time. She never takes it easy on me.
As long as she knows she can have that connection with you, I'm sure she'll continue to beat you. If you withdrew your love, right, I don't know if she would beat you.
See, that's what I find about it's tough about understanding women is they're just kind of tricky that way. They kind of want both. But hey,
well, every human being wants to have the experience of being right and of being validated, right? Sure. But women have the more complicated situation where we also want you to be validated. I mean, honestly, this is what our whole conversation was about the first 45 minutes, right? It's because I can't stand to say that person's wrong, because there's some, in a sort of universal sense, there's some reason why everyone's doing everything.
So Dr. Mossbridge, tell us about this new position that you're taking at the IONS Institute. Give people a little bit of a brief reminder of who is IONS, and then tell us what you're going to be doing there.
Oh, sure. IONS is the Institute of Noetic Sciences. So that's N-O-E-T-I-C for people who've never heard that word. Noetic comes from this Greek word gnosis, G-N-O-S-I-S. And it's this idea that we have wisdom inside of us that can be tapped to actually give us information that's useful. And it's taken, the IONS has spent more than 40 years, coming on 50 years, taking serious, rigorous looks at the science of wisdom and how that comes to us. And that has evolved into trying to understand mental influences on matter, trying to understand consciousness, trying to understand presentiment, precognition, telepathy, survival of consciousness after death. So it has its fingers in all of those pies as an institute, but its overarching goal is to use scientific rigor to look at these kind of phenomena that people have reported for thousands of years. So that's the goal. That's the goal of IONS. And right now it's going through a growth period with its president, Cassandra Beaton, who has this kind of amazing image of what will come. And she's strengthening the scientific team and growing it. So now I believe there are 7 or 8 staff scientists, growing from only 2 in the last, 3 years ago, I think there were only 2, and now there's 7 or 8. And we're also building an innovation lab. And the purpose of the innovation lab is to bring these kind of noetic technologies, or technologies that come out of really taking a serious scientific look at these things, and bringing them to people around the world as apps or kits that they can use at home. So people actually see, look, this is useful. This is real. And I can invite my science friends over who have problems with this, and I can show them this app, you know, or have them download it themselves. So the idea is to spread the word that these kind of ideas that are, we call noetic ideas, which are all about telepathy, precognition, etc., are real and actionable, and we can make useful things from them. So that's what the Innovation Lab is about. And it's also about trying to foster some sense of self-transcendence. So trying to get people into having practices that they can do on a daily basis that help them look towards other people and help them look beyond themselves and get in a frame of mind where they realize that they have a lot of resources that they can offer to other people. So those two goals are where we're heading with the Innovation Lab, and I'm pretty excited about that.
Awesome. What specifically are you going to be focusing on early on? Do you have any ideas in terms of what you're going to bring? You developed a little app, I know. I mean, are you going to be looking at further extending that, or what are you going to be doing?
Choice Compass, yeah. That's the app I developed. It just uses heart math, some mathematics, mathematical analysis of heartbeat patterns when you're thinking about 2 life choices to help tell you which one is more positive based on my previous testing. What I'm going to do with that is I'm actually looking for a company that wants to license or sell that, because I don't have the business expertise to get that out in the world. And I think the people who have used it so far have really enjoyed it, but I just don't know how to put that out there in a way that really scales it up. So what I'm going to do with that is try to find someone who knows how to do that. And then I will leverage my experience as an entrepreneur, as a scientist/entrepreneur building that, in the innovation lab so we can build other apps that can get out there and we can have other people bring to scale.
Great. So it sounds like very exciting things going on at IONS, and I wasn't aware that they had that they were going through that kind of growth in the terms of the number of scientists. So that's awesome. What else is going on for you at Northwestern?
So at Northwestern, I have really productive relationships with several of the faculty in the psychology department. And I think I'll be working as a consultant on a grant from the Navy that's been given to one of my colleagues to try to help train people to become more intuitive. And so I think I'll be working on that grant. And I continue to just discuss with the faculty there as kind of, I think I'm kind of a backyard informant. So I come to them with, here's what I think is the best of this field. And many of them are sympathetic to these ideas about post-materialist ideas in consciousness, but maybe might not be ready yet to do research in that area. So I come in and I say, well, what about this? And what about that? And what have you looked at this study? And we have lots of conversations about that. And then that our conversations end up informing my work in the area. So it's just a very fruitful conversation and collaboration with the folks there.
Do you think there's any cosmic conflict between the idea of commercializing? Do you think we can use telepathy to predict the stock market and that everyone's going to use that?
I think precognition is better for predicting the stock market. And that's one of the apps that I'm of course working on. And I think we can use it. I think we should be using it. And I don't see any problem with it. I think it provides access. I think that kind of an app can provide access to thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands more people, access to the markets, because you don't have to have any financial expertise to bet on the market using precognition. So then you're talking about opening up the markets to a lot more people. I think that would change the way the markets work, and I think that's a very positive thing. So I don't see anything negative about that. I guess if you think of money as a negative thing, but I don't see money as a negative force. I see money as a force that can be misused, just like any other force.
Well, it's a great body of work. I hope this dialogue hasn't been too contentious. If people have made it through this far, I think they can see that we're really on the same page about so many of these things, that there's really just style differences.
Yeah, I think so. And honestly, I'm grateful to have this kind of conversation, because there's something about you, and I've never even known you before this conversation, but there's something about you that allows me to say what I was thinking very clearly to you without feeling like you're going to, you know what I mean? I could say like, hey, I feel attacked or whatever. And I would know that I still feel safe with you, interestingly, right?
Well, I hope so. I mean, I think it's there's a profound sense of hopelessness.
Yeah.
In a lot of folks who approach the sciences.
Yeah, yeah.
And they
yeah.
get halfway in and they feel just a desperation that if they want to pursue this area of intellect and reason, that they're going to have to give up their soul in some way. And I think that message is reinforced over and over again. So I don't think it hurts to stand up and say that some of these people just really aren't firing on all cylinders in terms of incorporating the data into their model. And maybe that helps us explain why their model is so skewed from mm-hmm. our reality. Because, mm-hmm. Julia, you and I know that we love our kids deeply, that mm-hmm. we have a deep cosmic connection, not only with our children and with my wife and my family, but with as many people as I can expand my heart to reach. And the mm-hmm. fact that when I turn to science, I'm forced to leave all that behind and deny that and put that on the shelf is a dirty, rotten shame. And that's what gets me riled up. And I think we need to change that.
Well, I totally agree. And I also have had the experience of feeling like I was forced to change that. And that's why I left that UCSF program. I absolutely felt like I was being told, you get to have your soul or you get to be a scientist, but you don't get to have both. And it took about 5 years of just not doing science and sort of self-development for me to say, no, I'm going to do science because it is part of my soul. And so I can't do science without my soul because I require it to do it. It's a mystical path for me. I don't know for anyone else, but for me, it's a mystical path that requires a connection with God or the universe, and it requires my soul. And so that's how I got the strength to go back into it with my soul. But I remember almost losing it. I remember almost just saying, oh, I guess to succeed, I have to do this. And now I'm dead, you know, and then railing against that. And not everyone has the strength to do that. I mean, I just happen to come from a family where insights into your own experience were very much treasured at the same time as intellectual rigor. And so because I came from that family, I could kind of analyze what was going on and say, now, wait a minute, this is not true. I don't have to let go of my soul to have any kind of rigor. And so I'm sad for people who weren't raised in that situation. And I think that's a lot of people.
Well, I think it's also just the personality. You are extremely brave. You are a truth teller of the first order. And a bodhisattva who has gone over and climbed the wall and come back to share it with the rest of us. And I think that's, you know, rare and unique. And I think your womanhood that you bring to it, which is, you know, kind of coming out in a lot of different ways, which is awesome. You know, I mean, I don't think you back off of in your presentation, and people can go on your YouTube presentations and watch it. I mean, I just get the sense that you're comfortable being a woman in science. It doesn't get, I mean, this is maybe, I don't know how to really tell people that in a more kind of specific way, but I just get the sense that you're someone who's also saying, you know, it's okay for me to be a woman up here. I'm not trying to play a man's game. And I think that's awesome as well. So I'm all in for Julia Mossbridge. I think you're doing great. And I just wish you the best of luck.
Well, I'm all in for you. I really appreciate our conversation. I don't usually get to have this level of conversation with people who interview me. So I'm delighted. And this is my favorite interview so far. So thanks.
Awesome. Okay, Julia, well, let's stay in touch. Maybe we'll even bump into each other along the road, and that'd be awesome sometime. But definitely let's stay in touch and let me know when something amazing happens, and I'd love to tell people about it.
Oh, you know what we didn't talk about that at some point maybe we should?
Please. No, go ahead, and I'll just edit it back in.
I did this cell phone experiment that essentially used heartbeat to validate the same thing I saw with men and women with presentiment. How I talked about the skin conductance stuff. Well, I redid it using cell phones. So I had 300 people, 150 men, 150 women, because they could just download an app that I made to record their heart activity as they did the do you win $2 or do you not win $2 experiment. And I got the same effect that I got in the lab.
So what are you monitoring in terms of heart, like the heart variance between beats, or the number of heartbeats, the rate, or?
Just what's the interpeak interval. So a peak is like a heartbeat. And so just the interpeak interval is the number of milliseconds in between heartbeats. Yeah. And if you take the average of the 10 seconds of the interpeak intervals preceding winning $2, and you compare that to the average of the 10 seconds of the interpeak intervals preceding not winning $2, you find the exact same pattern that I showed in the lab with skin conductance. So you find that men have this significant difference before winning $2 versus not winning $2. Women do not. And there's this significant gender difference between them. And it's in the same direction in terms of men being more aroused in terms of heartbeats, before they're about to win the $2. And this was done on a single trial study again. So it's only one trial. So you can't worry about what the previous trial has taught them. Or you can, but it would be foolish because there's no previous trial. And it's done on cell phones. So people downloaded, had 150 men and 150 women download this app that actually performed the experiment for them. All they had to do was put their finger over the camera lens, which recorded the changes in the red value in their finger and then extrapolated heartbeats from there. So it was a very simple experiment.
This is awesome. So you put your finger over the camera and it measures this change in the physiology of your heart. Yeah. And then that's tied into the app, and the app says, the app is really simple. It's just, did you win $2 or did you not win $2? And they have to predict whether they're about to win or not.
Yeah. And they can't predict, not very good at predicting consciously, but physiologically their heartbeats. If they're men, their heartbeats predict it.
Do you really win the $2 if you win?
Yeah, you do. Of course.
Wow, this is great. I want to sign up for that. I want to win.
Well, actually, I'm redoing the experiment now to see if I can replicate it using $4 and $6, because the more I want to see like a dose response. So the more something matters, then maybe the more we see this presentiment effect, you know?
Cool. Let me know when it gets up above 100 and then I'm in.
Okay, I will.
Thanks again to Dr. Julia Mossbridge for joining me today on Skeptico. One question to tee up from this interview. How should we address the perceived inadequacies of the neuroscience model of consciousness? Am I being too hard on Christof Koch? Am I maligning him and other neuroscientists that seem to me to be holding on to this view that is swamped by the data? Do we all need to just go along to get along a little bit more? I have my opinion, but I'll be interested to see what you think. Place to do it, of course, is through the Skeptico website at skeptiko.com. From there, you can bounce on over to the forum, leave a comment right there after the show, or drop me an email or connect with me on Facebook. You know, the last episode of Skeptico had over 1,000 shares through Facebook, so that's great. Love to see people sharing this content. How wonderful to think that it's going to more people and more people are finding it interesting. So I encourage you, if you like the show, if you like this episode, go to the website and share it. Share it on Facebook, Twitter, whatever means you see necessary. And also, please use those other means to connect. Connect with us on Facebook, connect with me through the forum, or just drop me an email. I'm always here and glad and look forward to hearing about your experience with the show, your suggestion for future guests we might have, or anything else that might be on your mind. Well, as I mentioned previously, I have quite a few shows in the hopper, and they are going to come out once a week for a while. So I have another couple of shows. I'm dying to get these shows out, a couple of shows on Christianity. Really excited about bringing these to you. So those will be the next two, and then we'll see where it takes us from there. But until next time, do take care. Bye for now.